Wisconsin State Employees Union. Mr. Kobelt.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Kurt Kobelt. I represent defendants, appellants, Wisconsin State Employees Union. The primary issue before the court is, would anyone familiar with the real-world context of the contract at issue wonder whether it requires the employer to pay 90% of their retiree health insurance premium? That is the test this court established in FDIC.
Yeah, but your arguments really bother me, because this is as clear a contract as I've ever seen. And you want to turn it into a trial with all sorts of testimony of people who proposed what and why. I don't know what's left of the notion that you can protect yourself from a trial by clear written language if you can get away with this argument.
Well, as this court has recognized in the W.R. Grace case and many other cases, there are many situations where contract language can appear at first blush to be crystal clear.
It's not at first blush. First blush, second blush, and third blush, it's perfectly clear. It's not that it becomes unclear when you start looking at other things. It's still perfectly clear, right? It's not like the Peerless case, right? It's our favorite case. The contract on its face says, ship cotton by the ship Peerless. It's completely clear on its face. Turns out there are two ships sailing, from Bombay to Liverpool or whatever. So that, the contract is no longer clear. But even after, with all your evidence, it's still perfectly clear. 90% of the premiums are paid for by the employer, period. You never succeed in showing an ambiguity. You just try to show, well, that's what it says, but they didn't really believe that. They didn't mean that.
Well, it's more than that, Your Honor. It's a question of what did the parties...
It's so intricate, your arguments. Who proposed what and why would they ever propose something that was against their interest? It's just so complicated. I mean, you could turn any contract suit into a jury trial by that kind of stuff, trotting out witnesses to say, what's left of the parole evidence rule when you have all this discussion, what they really meant and this and that.
Well, I mean,
they didn't want the 90%. Why didn't they say no 90%, right? Employee pays 100%. Why didn't they just say that?
Well, the parties to the contract, Your Honor, in negotiating it, have an understanding of the contract that admittedly was...
That's the whole point of the parole evidence rule. You don't get into negotiations. You have an integrated written contract. It's the complete agreement of the parties. You don't go behind that except in extraordinary circumstances, like the Peerless case, where once you find out there are two ships, both sailing, different dates from the same cities, you just know that you cannot rely on the written contract, because the written contract will not tell you. It doesn't say which ship. It just says the ship Peerless. You can't rely on the contract in that case. In this case, no problem. 90% is 90%.
But how can you rely on a contract with the parties during two negotiations?
Because that's the whole point of the parole evidence rule. You cannot come up and say, look, the contract is perfectly clear, it's an integrated document, but in the negotiations, well, we actually were thinking of something else. That's what the parole evidence rule establishes.
Did parties agree? Was there a mutual agreement to change the conditions?
Yes, there were. There were two negotiations.
That was a second contract, you're saying?
Well, in the second negotiations, the parties...
I'm not interested in the negotiations. Was there an ultimate contract which altered the terms of the first contract?
Yes.
And where's that?
Yeah.
That was the first contract. The language wasn't the same, but the second contract that was negotiated in the year 2000 added this language where
That's not applicable. That's a later contract. They didn't modify the earlier contract.
But it's certainly
period.
It's relevant to the question.
But it's not a modification. In answer to Judge Bowers, but it's not a modification of the contract. It's a new contract.
Well, it's a new contract.
Period.
But it's a new contract that shows what the parties interpreted the language at issue to mean.
That's different from a modification of a contract. That's another effort on your part to bring in other evidence to try to show what this earlier contract meant. If the contract had been modified, fine. If it wasn't modified, that's your problem. Just a later contract, which you think casts light on the party's intentions in the earlier contract.
And in the Cherry versus Auburn Hill case, this court looked at a later contract to see if it cast light. It found it didn't, but it was a relevant piece of evidence to look at. And then the problem here, Your Honor...
Look what it does to contracts. So if you have a clear contract, then you say, oh, but later the parties made a different contract. Let's look at the different contract and see what light it casts on what they were really thinking. And they said 90, but they meant, you know, zero. No, that's just too in my opinion, it's just too unsettling. We like to get written contracts. We like them to be decided by the judge reading the contract, not having a trial.
But certainly,
when
you're
it's
right.
Clear.
Yeah. Well, it should be. I mean, that's obviously the commendable rule. But we're still left with the fact that the parties at the bargaining table have a completely opposite interpretation.
Again, have you never heard of the parole evidence rule? You're not allowed to say, we have this integrated document that says X, but in the negotiations leading up to it, we were actually thinking Y. That's the parole evidence rule. Very important rule.
It's more than that we were
thinking.
All
you keep talking about, negotiations, bargaining, that's what you can't talk about. The
negotiations and bargaining you're discussing led to the second contract, which is a later one. Am I correct in that analysis?
That's correct, Your Honor. In the first contract, the union tried to get this in. It failed. And the second contract, it tried again and got it in the contract this time.
But that's a separate contract.
Well, it's a later contract after he retired.
Right.
But the fact, it is a bizarre and unusual factor, but the parties, both the union, which is an adversary party to the employer, the union shared the employer's interpretation as that the employees had to pay 100%. It based its proposals on it. It was prepared to strike based on those proposals. Where did that understanding come from? Admittedly, contrary to the clear terms, that understanding had to come from somewhere, and it came from the practices where the two employees who retired before were both made to pay 100%.
But what's the evidence that they knew that they were being screwed? I don't understand. Were they told, look, it says in your contract we pay 90%, but actually we're paying 0%. Is that what they told these two people? Or did they just give them a number? This is the deduction from your sick leave. Well, leave it to them to figure out, you know, how much of the premiums is being paid by the employer.
Well, the declarations, Your Honor, indicate that the union was made aware of both situations.
Now, answer my question. Were these two people told that although the collective bargaining agreement says the employer pays 90%, actually it's paying 0%? Were they told that?
They were not told, but their union was told, Your Honor. And the
How
union
do we know
didn't
they
do
were told?
How do we know they were not told?
Mm-hmm. They were not told. So what's the significance of their having... They should be suing if their statute of limitations hasn't run. They weren't told this was being done to them. That's very irresponsible.
Well, I could sue the union,
your
too.
Client.
Well, their union was told, and the union didn't do anything about it because the understanding was you look to the state employees contract, which they all knew, which had the requirement
so
employees
the
pay 100%.
Schemes here, but these two people, since they didn't know it was happening, you can't use it as their understanding of what their rights were.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, talk about, I mean, if the court sustains...
I mean, sometimes unions just sell out the interests of some of their members, right? Because they have to balance it against other...
Well, this is not the case of a sellout union. It's a small in-house union where you can assume the union appointed the members of the bargaining team. The bargaining team advances a proposal which is based on a shared understanding between management and labor.
How
which
do
said
you have
that,
a shared understanding in the face of this language? What's the... How does it... How does,
And in the collective bargaining context, there are as you're aware, many unwritten understandings, tacit understandings, the law of the shop understandings. This was one of those understandings, Your Honor.
In other words, you're saying collective bargaining agreement isn't worth the paper it's written on, that if you get into a dispute over its meaning, then you throw it out and you start dragging in witnesses to talk about understandings and this is and that's and the other thing.
Well, no, a contract can be disregarded when the parties themselves disregard that contract and make proposals and enter into agreements based on a different understanding than what the contract says. The parties here admittedly were derelict. They were negligent, perhaps, in not changing it.
That's a good. You could stop right there. They were derelict. They were negligent, and they didn't change the language, so they're stuck with it. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Colwell. Mr. Townsend.
Steven, get up and talk him out of his position.
My comments will be brief.
You're a wise man.
Ross Townsend for the plaintiff appellees, Ron and Euphemia Orth. I have no intention of talking the court out of his or your position. I believe the question.
Well, we don't have a position. We've just been tormenting your opponent.
Well,
I'll try to do the same to you if you give us a chance.
That's what I was suggesting. Get up there and let them whack at you.
All right. Yes, sir. We believe that the contract is, in fact, an unambiguous statement of the procedures that were to be applied to retiree health and benefits. It says 90-10. And no matter how the defendants may try to explain that away, the evidence that they propose to introduce does not create an ambiguity in the contract. The contract says 90-10. There is nothing in the black and white words on the page of the agreement that can possibly be construed to say that retirees have to pay 100%. And that is the pivotal issue on this whole concept.
Do you think that the union was trying to sell their union members down the river?
I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. Frankly, we didn't explore why they did what they did because it's been our position that it's irrelevant. I have an idea if you'd like me to share that with you.
Go ahead, sure.
I think this was the product of an oversight, at least initially. There were only a couple of individuals.
Oversight on whose behalf?
On the part of the employer, I think that
How about the union?
I'm sorry?
How about the union? You think they...
I think the union believed, and the declaration of the president of the union would support the fact that they had no idea that this was going on. Mr. Kobelt's declarations indicate that there were two individuals on the bargaining team, one of whom was the former president of the employer, who was aware that the employer was withholding 100% of the premiums. But I believe the union, I believe the declaration of the president of the union, as well as the declarations of my client and several other people, one of whom was Mr. Passo, one of the two retirees, they had no idea that the union was withholding 100%
of
the premiums.
After the first contract was entered into and further negotiations were opened, did any of those negotiations result in another written contract?
There was a series of contracts. The contract at issue here is the 98, I believe it's 97 to 98 agreement, the agreement that was in place when Mike, and what part of their...
But there's a subsequent agreement.
There is, yes. There's several subsequent
agreements.
Several
of them all reduced to writing?
Yes.
Any of them refer to the first one?
No, not with regard to this issue.
Okay.
So in my opinion, the CEU was unaware of it. I think the employer made a mistake some point in the distant past, and that just sort of became status quo, and as long as the CEU didn't complain or raise any issues about it, everything was just fine. When Mr. Orth brought this whole issue to light in 2006, that was the first time that the CEU really was aware that this was going on. At least the officers and the representatives and the rank and file of the CEU was aware of the fact that the employer was charging the retirees 100% rate. And if you look at the facts, the reason for that is that the way this was set up, the premiums were pulled out of this this account that the employees had, and there was no statement.
You wouldn't notice, right?
I'm sorry?
You wouldn't notice unless you were really curious.
Precisely.
You just know, you just see a bottom line.
Well, actually, there was not even a bottom line. There was no statement sent to retirees. They, the first time that my client ever saw anything from the CEU was in 2006 when he got a notice that said,
that it
your account is about gone.
Yeah,
and he was stunned and said, well, how can that be?
And, so, and he couldn't even get an accounting of how his accrued sick leave was spent by the defendant.
That's right. We repeatedly requested that they consider, that they give us an explanation, and that was not forthcoming. And frankly, that was one of the factors that forced Mr. Orth to retain our firm and to file his lawsuit. And interestingly, that goes to the issue, I believe, of attorney's fees, and I know that's one of the issues that's on appeal here. And it goes to whether the district court abused its discretion when he awarded attorney's fees in this case. Of course, it's our position that he did not abuse that discretion.
Oh, I was shocked.
I'm sure you are, Your Honor, in light of the presumption that attorney's fees are recoverable, in light of the fact that that Judge Williams points out, there is substantial justification to award fees in this case.
Keep it up, pretty soon you're going to serve one up and you can get hit with it.
I'll see what I can do. The standard, the Devane case that we cite in our brief on attorney's fees is, we believe, the standard that's applicable here, that no reasonable person could conclude that the court abused its discretion in awarding. We don't believe that there's any indication that the district court abused its discretion. With regard to the claim by the defendants that the district court's decision was contradictory, I'd like to just comment briefly on that, and then I'll...
Why?
That's a very good question, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm going to...
Okay,
thank you. If you have any more questions,
Mr.
I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will sit down. Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
So, Mr. Cole, your time expired, but we'll give you another minute since... maybe you want to address the attorney's fee question.
Well, thank you, Your Honor, I'll be brief. Just to cut to the chase here, what we have, this is not your normal industrial situation where you have a factory worker who negotiates contracts part-time and a management who negotiates contracts part-time. These are professional union negotiators on both sides of the bargaining table. For this court to uphold the lower court's decision, and the decision is scattered with references, the parties didn't know what the contract meant. They were ignorant of the contract terms. For this court to uphold that decision would mean that these professional, on both sides of the table, these professional full-time union negotiators didn't know what they were doing when they negotiated their own contract.
That's not the issue. It's the contract is clear. It doesn't matter what they thought or didn't think. That's the extrinsic evidence that you want to get in.
And on the attorney fees question, it is true, isn't it, that Mr. Orth couldn't even get an accounting of the dollars and how much he had paid.
Well, he did get the accounting. I don't think that's relevant, Your Honor, for purposes of attorney's fees. The question is whether the employer's position here is substantially justified. And the court itself found the parties...
But the bottom line was he asked for it, and he couldn't get it till after he retained counsel.
He did ask for it, and he was told that the person who had the information had other commitments and would get back to him. He was told the information, I believe, prior to again getting counsel. But again, I don't think that's relevant for attorney's fees purposes.
Did she get back to him?
She did ultimately get back
ultimately,
to him.
Ultimately, how long was that?
Well, it was in the fall of 2006 when he was told, he was given a letter in response. He wrote a letter in August.
How long in response to his inquiry?
He inquired in August, and he was sent a letter. I believe the letter was dated in September, but he didn't get the letter until October or November. But he did get a letter
I don't understand. It was dated in September, and he didn't get it till October or November. How does that work?
Well, I that's not clear, Your Honor. But the point, he was told over the phone.
I understand you.
He was told
over the
phone.
The letter is dated in September, received in November.
And we can't explain that, Your Honor. The record is unclear.
It wasn't mailed until November.
It wasn't mailed until November. But he was told over the phone.
Could have blamed it on the postal system, you know.
He was told over in a telephone conversation, Your Honor, that his time had run out. And that happened in the spring.
But what he wanted was an explanation of why it had run out, because he couldn't figure out why his time had run out when he knew that he was only responsible for 10%. And he knew how many days it was in his sick bay, but he didn't get any breakdown. It's not enough to just say your time had run out.
I understand.
Anyway.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.